Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan present Point Taken, a podcast connecting you to the sports and pop culture issues you care about and the guests you want to hear more from. Now, here's Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady.
This is episode 4 of Point Taken. IV, for those learning Roman numerals. No one learns those in school anymore. Did you know that? Are you good with Roman numerals?
I am not, so I think they stopped teaching back when I was in school.
I lived in Detroit during Super Bowl XL, and everyone just called it the extra large Super Bowl.
Were they wrong?
They were not reasonably wrong. I'm sure the Super Bowl has been better in places where it's not minus 15 for every single. It's in Minneapolis this year. Did you know that?
Yeah, that'll be nice and toasty.
Yeah, change from Houston and the Bay Area.
Ugh.
So we've got a lot coming up. Jesse Levine, former, I mean, he is right now a former ATP tennis player. He's doing some coaching. Has he coached you personally in your game?
We can touch on that. He did once, and I think he probably regretted it.
You're
he
difficult.
Has to go for a hit when he was in town.
You're a difficult patient?
Yeah, I got a free tennis lesson. I still feel a bit bad.
Well, he should invoice you. Maybe he will.
Maybe we shouldn't bring it up then, actually.
Now he's coming on your podcast. You must have done something for him at some point in time.
I really haven't. I guess I helped him when he first, because he's done a couple broadcast stuff for Sportsnet, for Rogers Cup. He did it last year, and then he did Davis Cup just this year.
Yeah,
so.
He's good. I saw him
on
Davis Cup.
Yeah.
Some people you're never sure
how to work.
If there's a future. Like this whole NFL thing leading up to this year, people are dying to see how the engaging, enigmatic Tony Romo is, and they're dying to see how the surly, at times grumpy, eye-rolling Jay Cutler is. And I'm actually looking forward to Jay Cutler. Like
Me
we
too.
Told Richard Deitch the first week, I'm like, this weirdly might work. I'm sure no one thought automatically Don Cherry would be a 40, 45-year phenomenon as a broadcaster. I'm sure there was an exec somewhere in 1979 or 80 who was like, don't think we should use him anymore. And where's that person now? We'll never know.
I'll just be interested to see if Jay Cutler brings the energy. He's so chill.
But do you want him to bring? I mean, not necessarily.
Of energy, but enough to get his point across on television.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there are some color commentators who are just very, I wouldn't say they're dry, but they're not.
Serious.
Yeah. They're not very wet. Like if they're dry, wet's the opposite of dry. Craig Simpson is not. He won't blow you away with the volume won't peak on your TV, but he's insightful and he's measured and he's thoughtful. But he doesn't tend to he's not a yeller or a screamer.
No.
Craig Simpson, is he?
But he's got energy.
He's got energy. Yeah. Speaking of, so we'll talk to Kelly Rudy from Hockey Night in Canada in a little bit as well. As we record this, it's the day of game 2 between the Pens and the Predators. And the storylines seem to be. Pens didn't have a shot for 37 minutes, and a self-described redneck threw a catfish on the ice.
I loved that.
In Pennsylvania, and has been arrested with
and he goes on the radio the next day and calls himself a redneck and explains in great detail. The interview is about 12 minutes on Nashville radio about why he brought the catfish in, why he threw it on the ice. I'm sorry, but that is idiotic, is it not?
It is, but the way he described it, the takeaway from the 12 seconds of the 12-minute interview I heard was that he had sprayed the catfish with cologne because as he smuggled in, he's like, they're going to smell the catfish. Like the usher will remove me from the catfish and the catfish from me. So here's some Polo or Blue Stratus, something cheap, I would hope. I don't think he's digging deep into the Calvin Klein ranks. Not that that's necessarily deep.
What's the mindset? I always want to know.
Of cologne-wearing men?
No.
I don't know.
Of someone bringing something like that into a game. Do you just wake up in the morning and think, you know what? Before I go to work, I think I'll go pick up a catfish.
It's on your to-do
list.
I'll
spray it with cologne and vacuum seal it and
what if you're
shove
not
it
the
in
only,
my hands.
And what if you're not the only one? Like, I'm sure in Detroit, 5 people
have
brought octopi at any given time. And the other 4 are like, I missed my moment. That guy went first. What do I do? I mean, now I'm just copying him. I'm showing I'm not really in on all the trends. And like, I'm the 9th person to buy the Lonzo Ball shoes. And, you know, the first 8 guys did ahead of me.
My purse is heavy enough. I don't need to put any dead fish or animals in
there. I haven't seen you carry a gigantic. Well, there's a reasonably, you could get a sunfish in there and give
starfish. And give it, that'd be a very friendly thing to throw on the ice, a starfish.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens in Nashville, because if you might remember, a lot of people were up in arms because a duck, right, was thrown on the ice.
That bothered me.
It bothered me too, because we. And yet we don't have the same respect for octopi and like walleye and trout that might get thrown onto an ice surface. We're just like, that duck had a family. It taught other ducks to fly. It went to reunions. It traveled. It took its kids on vacation south in the winter. It did a lot.
You're right, though. The logic is not is not there.
So would you look and say... I have two thoughts, and we'll see what Kelly's thought is leading in, and then we'll when people listen to this back, they'll know whether he was right or not, which is the fun part of recording something in advance. The prevailing thought is Nashville feels really good that they dominated large portions of game one, or they'll feel Pittsburgh isn't going to play that badly again, and that was a huge opportunity, and we missed it. And they haven't trailed in a series either. They've been the front runners because they got up 2-0 on Chicago and up 2-0 on St. Louis.
I think it's the latter, where they think Pittsburgh's not going to play that poorly, and we had a missed opportunity. Because, I mean, the whole game would have been changed if P.K. Subban's goal had counted to open the scoring. But that was called offside after the coach's challenge. But the 37 minutes without a shot for Pittsburgh, and then I could not believe they won it in regulation. It was one of the most confusing, strangest games I've ever seen.
Well, it felt like either Nashville gets the fourth goal or it goes to overtime.
Yes.
It was one or the other. There wasn't a third option where Pittsburgh scores on the very first shot.
No.
And I know people will say Pekka-Rinne was rusty. I didn't mind the goal. I didn't think it was a bad goal in that close. From where Gunsel was, it was a great shot. Sometimes you got to give credit to the scorer and not blame the goalie. But as we all know, the stat line where you make 7 saves in a Stanley Cup game he only had 11 shots, but it doesn't reflect well on the goalie. So we'll see how he is for game 2. Kelly Rudy wouldn't be able to relate to such a poor Stanley Cup final score line, but he's had to bounce back from finals losses before, as he did in 1993. So we can ask him about that. Yeah, it's one of those scenarios also where we're going to get to Jesse LaVine. We're also going to talk a little bit about the NBA because we're not ready to have another week of games. And when we join people next week, I think we'll have 3 games, at least the 2 under our belt. There's a game Thursday and then a Sunday.
Yep.
Early start. Now you're a bit of a late night vampire with your hours,
right?
And I'm going to bed earlier, but Sunday thrills me already because it's an 8 o'clock start instead of a 9 o'clock start. That makes all the difference in the world to me being able to make sure the eyes aren't getting bleary. And yet I plan to stay up for every single one of these games. I would anyway in the NBA finals, but the third straight final in a row.
Three match.
With the same 2 teams.
I can't wait. I just keep thinking, please, 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 after all this time we waited in the NBA playoffs, and I'm sorry, but boring games, please give me a good NBA finals. And I think it will be good.
I think it will be good, too. And yet we've been so spoiled by these 2 teams. They're 12-1 in the playoffs. I was thinking the other day, if these 2 teams didn't exist, if they went and played in another league, we wouldn't be there very excited about the 28 remaining teams left in the NBA. They're sort of carrying the league right now. From an entertainment perspective, they've got, say, 3 of the 5 best players. They may have 4 of the 5 best players if we consider Kyrie Irving's ascension.
I think so.
To lump in with Curry and Durant and LeBron James. And, and the same thought I had with the league after LeBron. LeBron's not going to pull a Michael Jordan and retire after this year, but we'd have a real void with an NBA without LeBron James right now.
Well, I can't imagine it at this point in the NBA. I'm just excited to see if because he keeps getting better every single year, and that's what's terrifying for everybody else in the league. I'll be interested to see how good he is in this finals, if he turns it up another notch, if he has another level to get to, because the Cavs are the underdog.
They are, and I feel like they're too much of an underdog, but it's something we can pursue in a little bit. I keep reading, we had Donovan Bennett on our morning show, and he's picking a Golden State sweep.
Really? That would stink.
It would
even
stink.
If it's close games, it would stink.
It would stink, and it would also stun me. But I think a lot of us have been wrong about some of the last several NBA finals. I didn't think Golden State was going to blow a 3-1 lead last year. They won their first 2 games at home. No one thought LeBron would lose that first year in Miami when they played the Dallas Mavericks and Dirk Nowitzki.
Mm-hmm.
Kobe and Shaq lost the finals in 04 to a kind of an okay Detroit team.
Mm-hmm.
So there've been several in the last, we always think the best team always wins the NBA finals because Michael Jordan taught us that, and the best player on the planet and the best team on the planet went 6-0 in finals in the 90s, but it doesn't always work out that way. So more of that, what up with that? We'll finish the show right after Jesse
Levine. Oh, love what up with that.
You've been working diligently on stories that couldn't necessarily make your Sportsnet Central newscast.
Yeah.
Sportscast are on What Up With That in a little bit. But we welcome in longtime NHL goaltender, and of course, he's been putting in long hours himself. Oof. On the Hockey Night in Canada panel. Nary a day off. He loves it when those series go to seven games and double overtime as well. Kelly Rudy joins us now. We can see it sometimes, you're right in that middle spot there. When Nick leans a little one way and Elliot leans another way, you're the one that has to stay straight up and not nod off and not look for a pillow anywhere. It's been a good run for you guys.
It really has. We're thrilled that we're on the road now here in Pittsburgh and then going to Nashville. There's nothing like a playoff game, and it's even better when you're on location. I mean, there's atmosphere. You feel the energy in the building. Like, we went to three games in Ottawa as well. And as much as I love the studio show and we have different resources there, when you're live in a building, to me, it's just really energizing because you feel that atmosphere that everybody else is drinking in.
So folks will hear this after game two, more than likely. But I'd ask this, we know about the Nashville atmosphere, and Carolyn and I have talked about that, and you guys have too. How much does it get sapped with a Pittsburgh game two win? Because I remember going to game three in Boston, and Vancouver was up 2-0 6 years ago. Kelly, you remember that series, and they just felt like this is inevitable. We're not winning 4-4, and they did, but they're not winning 4-5 against this team. So for all the Preds' excitement, it really gets tempered Saturday night without a win this evening, doesn't it?
You know, I understand that thinking, but for me, I go into every game like I do every sort of season. They all have a different flavor. Every game is unique to me. I know that we sometimes talk about there's carryover and there's, you know, this residual, whether it's damage from, you know, some non-calls or some bad breaks or bad penalties. I always look at every single game as a unique sporting event. And so for me, I'm looking for tonight an entirely different game than we saw last game. Unique circumstances, everything's different. I always go back to my first coach in the National Hockey League, and I understand I was spoiled, Al Arbor. Mm-hmm. So he always had all these great lines about every game's different, and even more so to the point, I'm kind of getting off topic here, but every single season for this first 3 months, he would reevaluate every player on his roster, and that includes all the guys that had won consecutive cups for him. So that's how I kind of look at every individual playoff game. Everybody reacts differently to circumstances and to situations. And so I kind of like to think that everybody wipes the slate clean after every single game, whether it's a win or a loss. And players hopefully don't have the same sort of highs and lows that fans have if your team goes up 2-0 or drops the first two. So that's how I look at it.
As Greg said, Kelly, you played in that 93 Cup final against Montreal and Patrick Waugh. As a player, does the Stanley Cup final and every single game, does it feel different? Did you feel those nerves?
You know what? It's interesting, Caroline. When last game in the pregame show, I was talking about whether it's pressure or excitement, and Bill Guerin came on, and then he said he felt both those emotions, but then it really comes down to execution. So my feeling was, and I love this. I love this memory going back. So 93... when we were going to play Montreal in the finals, the very first game, first two games were in the Montreal Forum, so that historic building. I grew up in Edmonton. I never expected to be in the National Hockey League, nor did I ever know or expect that I'd be in the Stanley Cup finals in that building. So just prior to puck drop, just when we're walking out from our dressing room onto the ice, I was so excited. I remember excitement more than nervousness or any other feeling. And all I recall is just before my skates left the floor and went onto the ice. I'm standing in the gate going onto the ice, and I took a full 2 seconds to stop my progress and just look around the building and drink it all in. And that memory is still seared into my mind. So I just thought that because it's the finals, there was less pressure. We had already had some sort of degree of success. And I really enjoyed it. I never, even though we lost 3 consecutive games in overtime that finals, every single game I was positive and thought that we were going to win. I just thought that the odds would have to be against the Montreal Canadiens because they had won so many consecutive overtime games. Even game 5 back in Montreal when we were down 3-1, going into the game, I expected us to win. I was certain we were going back to LA for game 6.
I mean, the story of these playoffs, or one of the big stories, has been all the overtimes. 27, one shy of the record. And 1987, you were in net when the Islanders beat the Capitals, and that was the longest game in club history, a 4 overtime game 7. It was known as the Eastern Epic because it finished just before 2 a.m. on Easter morning. 73 saves. What do you remember most from that game?
I remember I was so dehydrated after the game. I'm going to say the game ended at 4:02, so you're correct about that. And that, after the handshakes and a little bit of a celebration, media requests and so on, I recall taking off my skates. I'm going to say it would have been around 2:15 or so. And I was so dehydrated that immediately my toes curled under. Because back then, I don't think goalies had water bottles on their net. And once you get dehydrated, there's no chance of rehydrating during a game. So the other thing I remember vividly is Andy Van Helleman was the referee. And he was, to me, the perfect referee at the time because he was really calm and relaxed. I recall a couple of times when there's a whistle in my own zone, and we're waiting for a puck drop, and he and I were chatting, and just I remember having a smile on my face and really enjoying the experience. I recall also my mom and dad telling me that they heard Harry Neal and Bob Cole talking about something like, wouldn't you like that guy to be your goalie? Look, we're in double or triple or quadruple overtime, and he's sharing a laugh with the referee. So lots of pleasant memories. Looking back, I didn't know it at the time, but that was going to change my hockey career to a certain degree because I was a relative unknown at that point. I was in the shadow of Billy Smith for good reason. He had won 4 consecutive Stanley Cups in his career, and that kind of put me on the hockey radar. That same summer, I was invited to play for Team Canada in the 87 Canada Cup. So at that point, things sort of took off for me. It's other than making the NHL, that might be my NHL highlight.
So these OTs and these Stanley Cup finals are no problem for you then, right?
I still always wonder, you know, I always do wonder because the position of goal, they're so much better than in our time. Equipment's better, all these different things. The systems are better, defensive style, structure, all that's better. I've always wondered why we don't have a guy that has beat my saves record so far. There's twice guys have made 72 saves. Ed Belfour made 72 and Roberto Luongo made 72 saves. And I've always wondered, why hasn't somebody made like 100 or more saves for the reasons I just said? Everybody's so much better now.
Well, while we were talking, I happened to research it, and I couldn't remember it. Glenn Sather complained in the 85 finals, the late Pelle Lindbergh would take a water bottle out and keep it on his net. And his quote after one of the games, maybe we should just have a bucket of chicken on our net. Like, maybe the goalies will get hungry. So he was very upset because there was a water bottle out there. And you're right. 2 years later, it was like, now you got 5-year-olds to take water bottles out. Nobody did it when we were younger, and now everybody does it. We've evolved, right?
I know. I totally agree. When Glenn said that, I was flabbergasted. Like, honestly, we're not allowed water to play bowl. And I even take it a step further. I remember when I was growing up and we'd be having practice or something, there'd be very few water bottles around. But when you take a sip of water, somebody would always inevitably say, hey, be careful, you'll get cramps or something. like today's fitness world, if you ever mention to anybody, hey, be careful, don't have too much water, they look at you like you're nuts.
It's fine. But before we started jogging, my kid said to me the other day, he said, when do people start jogging? And I'm like, I really don't have a good answer for that. He'll go see me go for a run. And I'm like, no, my grandparents didn't go. In the 1930s, you weren't going out for a 3-mile run. People would assume you were running. You were running away from something if you were running in the 30s and 40s, right?
Yeah, you're right, Craig. That's funny.
It's changed a fair bit. So, atmosphere-wise, we talk about legacies too, and obviously being a teammate with a Wayne Gretzky, it begins and ends right, and a Brian Trotche and Mike Bossy and Dennis Botvin, it begins and ends right there. Tell us what you think a third cup does for Crosby and for Malkin, because we say they're fantastic players, but as we know post-cap, though Kane and Taves have done it, and L.A. did it twice, and that's about as close as we can ever get to the rivalries of the Islanders and the Oilers, it enhances things for Sidney. I mean, had he retired with one, and now maybe, just maybe, to win back-to-backs and make it three, that does something for him. It can't not.
I would agree, Greg. You know, he might be a little bit unique. First of all, it's hard to compare Crosby to Potvin and Gretzky and Messi and those guys and how many cups they were winning simply because in a salary cap era, it's more difficult. There's no question about it. And it might be like as much as 5 or 10 times more difficult. It's so unique to try and even get to the finals now with the pressures and the injuries and the cap issues, all those sorts of things. So, excuse me, I'm fighting allergies. So, yeah. But I think what Crosby has done last year by winning his second cup, the Olympic championships, all those sorts of things, that his legacy is cemented. I think that a guy like Malkin, though, on the other hand, he's still sort of building his. He's a wonderful career, done a ton, but in my opinion, he's not nearly as consistent of a player. You know, like in every single series, you get the best and worst of Malkin. You get an absolute star for maybe 2-3 games, and you get a guy that doesn't do enough in 2 or 3 or 4 games. So I think different players, but when you talk about the all-time greats, Crosby's going to be with the ones that the best that you can ever bring up.
And then the next generation of greats, we talk about Austin Matthews and Connor McDavid, and especially young Canadian teams with all this talent. We talk about the Leafs and the Oilers. You're part of the Flames regional broadcast throughout the year, so you've seen a lot of this team. Are they far behind the Leafs and the Oilers? Should we be giving them more credit?
Well, first of all, I don't think they have that one individual player that you're talking about. They don't have a McDavid. They don't have an Austin Matthews. Having said that, I think the core of their team is really strong. I've been really impressed with the growth that they've made this year. I think Brad Treliving is a big part of it, and especially the coaching staff led by Glenn Gullickson. I watched this team struggle mightily at points in the season, in particular in January. And to me, the coaching staff got that group out of that funk. They were lost. They weren't playing like they should have. And coaching staff really bared down at the end of January. They're finishing a terrible road trip. They were in Toronto. They were in Montreal. And then they had a train ride from Montreal to Ottawa, and that changed the entire season. The entire landscape changed. Gullickson went back to the train car that had just the players only and got them to start talking and sort of figure it out on their own. They won in overtime in Ottawa two nights later, and then they went on a great roll. Then they were the team that we expected. They were very consistent. They had great goaltending from Brian Elliott the rest of the way. They still have to add to their team, but I think that the steps that they made in the last half certainly exciting for next season for their fan base.
Okay, but we still need to finish this season, so we'll let you go and get some rest. It's like a weird social experiment, you spending this much time with the panel. Oh, I hope you survive.
Caroline, Greg, thanks. This was fun.
Have
pleasure,
fun.
Kelly. Thank you very much.
Okay, guys. Have a great day. Thanks for inviting me on.
Thank you. Have a good show tonight.
So there's Kelly Rudy. He was great. Great to have him on. Game two, of course, has been put in the books already. And we'll see what kind of atmosphere we get Saturday. 2-0 is not 3-0 for Nashville. But if they're going to make a series of it, as noted, they're going to have to win one game. They know this in Pittsburgh now. We'll see if it did happen. And I think we all want a long series. We haven't had a sweep since 1998 in the Stanley Cup Final. And as you noted, there are predictions. There is that fear to some extent in the NBA. We'll see what we get on Saturday when the series heads back to Tennessee.
Yeah, selfishly, I just want this to be a close, long series. And again, I know that probably ad nauseum we've been talking about how awesome Nashville's been to watch and watch their fan base see their team get this far. But I hope they do well. I hope they make it far. I think we're all acting like the Penguins will likely win.
Well, and you're also being super selfish because you don't want long games. You want a long series, but you don't want long games.
Because I work nights? No, I'm okay with OT, though. Just don't give me the 4-0 OT.
Because nothing was like more fun in Kelly's college than you're out of the bar, you get back, and you're out, and games are still going on at 1:15, 1:20
because you're out drinking, having a good time with your friends.
Yes, and you're younger, and you have no responsibilities, and you don't have to get up for a job or go to sleep for a job. Or any of that stuff. And yet you have $11 in your wallet.
Hey, at least these games start at 8 Eastern.
Yeah.
I like it.
That's the one.
We're not starting at 10 or 11, 10:30.
That tends to be the one benefit. And they've sort of sliced out I always feel like there should be one game. This is my theory on growing games for the younger generation. There should be one NBA Finals game, one World Series game, one Stanley Cup Final game that's on the weekend and it's in the daytime.
Yeah.
I do think that. I mean,
that actually makes sense.
No matter what, you're getting NBA games that aren't ending till 10:45 and NHL games that aren't ending till 10:20.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know
for the children.
I don't know how late you got to stay up when you were seven, but I had
not long.
Right, I had to fight and scratch
like 7 p.m.
once I got a television in my room.
Whoa!
When I was maybe
luxury
10.
That's
a small little tiny color TV that got about 6 channels. But it gave me the outlet to at least, you know, sneak in a lot of late games
right.
and late viewing.
I used to sneak into my, because, I mean, my parents would be downstairs with my two older brothers. And I used to, when I was supposed to be sleeping, sneak into my parents' room to watch TV and watch sports there. And then if they caught me, I would just lie and say I was writing a note for what time I needed to be at school the next day.
Kids are always sneaks, is I think no matter how good the parenting is, there's going to be you're raising a sneak.
Manipulative.
No matter what you think.
Thanks, Mom and Dad.
There's sneaky years and less sneaky years, and sneaky moments and less sneaky moments. So I was going to ask you about this, given you were in Vancouver as long as you were, and I went out there briefly for 2010 Olympics. I wasn't at London for 2012, but there's talk now. Paris is going to maybe be the only major city to bid for the 2024 Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And Los Angeles. There was a big push for Chicago to host the Summer Olympics a couple different times. It would be great.
Yeah.
It's drivable. And LA would push back from 2024 to go to 2028. Now, these events seem a long, long way away. We had Josie Altor on a couple weeks ago, and we're talking to him about the 2026 World Cup.
It'll be here before you know it. Time flies.
Well, we all could be walking with canes by then. I don't want to bearer of bad tidings. But it's interesting when you think about, there's always those stories with, and some are really pronounced, like in Sarajevo in 84, I remember that Olympics. And then obviously they had a terrible civil war breakout in the Balkans 8-9 years later. And naturally, the last thing they're on their mind was preserving a speed skating track or a skiing venue. But you see the pictures. I see the pictures of places where the Olympics were and have been. And it's empty stadiums. It's decrepit venues.
It's sad.
It's crippling debt. Like Brazil has done the Olympics and the World Cup within a span of 3 years. And they have no money. Like Rio, the city, is $31 billion in debt.
Wow.
And a lot of government buildings can't even keep power on. So I always cringe when I see things are coming up for the Olympics. And then
it's not going to change, though.
It's not going to change. And yet I read that, and I see that Paris and L.A. are probably two cities where there's an infrastructure, where there's already stadiums, there's already places to do things, and it makes sense to go back. Wouldn't you say Vancouver, if you could snap your fingers and say, hey, Vancouver's hosting the Winter Games in 2026. And
sure.
You go, yes, they're ready. They could do it. They just did.
Well, the Richmond Oval, it's used plenty. I mean, it's used Whistler and Cyprus Mountain. They were already there. You see the rings there. What's cool in Vancouver is it's still very much a part of the culture, and it's become tourist destinations. I mean, when you go to the top of Whistler, you take a picture by the Olympic rings. When you go to Cyprus, you do the same, where Bilodeau won his gold. The flame, the cauldron, I mean, it's even lit sometimes, which is just amazing when you're there with the mountains in the background. So, yeah, the infrastructure, some of it, because it's Winter Games, was there, was improved, too, like the Sea to Sky Highway. And, yeah, it is possible. But again, I mean, this is us logically thinking, but that's not what it's about. It's about the politics. It's about the money.
Yeah.
So it unfortunately, I really don't think it will change.
I know they've always, I mean, we've debated this here in Toronto since we separately were little kids. They tried to get the 96 games. It went to Atlanta. Mm-hmm. There was talk after we just did the Pan Am games here that that's the springboard to have Olympics. And you probably talk to just as many people as I do that say, please, no, because whether it's debt, whether it's the traffic concerns, whether it's the whole white elephant building thing. And yet the venues, everybody raved about the Pan Ams and the interest grew about the Pan Ams. And now there are better swimming venues. And we did refurbish some of the track venues.
And think of the waterfront in Toronto, how it would change if the Olympics came.
Yeah.
But you're right. As a fan, as a sports fan, as a fan of the Olympics, I'd love to see it come to Toronto. As a tax-paying citizen, I don't think it's necessarily the best idea. Not now, not yet. But
look out. Carolyn Cameron, tax-paying, did you ever think, tax-paying citizen. That is serious.
That made me sound pretty serious.
Is there anywhere in Europe you'd go, well, the Olympics were here,
I wish I'd gone to London.
To go. You would have gone to London.
Beach volleyball alone just looks so cool. I wonder what the next Canadian city will be to get the Olympics.
I feel like Barcelona would have been, I remember watching that on TV thinking that was, and then though there wasn't anything really that jumped out and was memorable. I want to say that's the Olympics for, we did well in rowing. Silken Lauman and Marty McBean had great Olympics that year, but Donovan Bailey obviously in 96 is what people remember, and the relay team. There wasn't a leap off the page moment from Barcelona, but it would have been an amazing city to witness an Olympic. And the next one's in Tokyo in 20. I almost forgot who had it. I remember the World Cups for soccer because we know they're coming to Russia. No thanks. And Qatar, even less thanks. But the next summer one's in Tokyo. And the next two winter ones are both Far East, right? South Korea and China.
Yeah. Hey, regardless of where they are, I'll be buying the merchandise because I am a sucker for some good Canadian apparel.
Yeah.
You know who's a proud Canadian?
I do.
Our next guest. Jesse Levine, he actually played under the American flag for many years, former ATP pro, career high ranking of 69 in 2012. Near the end of his career, he played under the Canadian flag. Born in Ottawa, moved to Florida as an early teenager, and because he was born in Ottawa, he is a major Ottawa Senators fan.
I'm not sure. Is this the right timing to bring that up?
Yeah, Jesse, it probably isn't. It's rough how I bring that up first. Have you gotten over it?
I'm working my way towards that. It was definitely a heartbreaking loss, but definitely a proud Sens fan. It was an amazing run and was so much fun to follow. And obviously not the result that we wanted, but still a proud Sens fan. Well, always will be.
Well, excellent use of the word we. You're doing fine. You're off to a good start in Sens Nation. Would you have come up for a game? Would you have tried to go to Nashville? Like, that's not a bad flight from where you are. You could have got to Tennessee.
Now you're really hurting me because I am actually headed to Europe tomorrow, and then I'm flying to Ottawa on the 8th, and we had tickets to the game. My family has season tickets, and they had told me that if we made the cup, I had tickets to that game. So now, way to just rub it in.
And way to go, Greg. Well, yeah, Paris. We've alienated our guests.
Paris is a terrible consolation prize.
True.
Where you've been before. That's terrible.
Yes. Yeah, it's awful. I know.
Have you been watching much of the tennis thus far at French Open? I mean,
I have. It's been great tennis, and it's been amazing conditions, actually. Usually Paris could be a little bit cooler and slower conditions, but lately, you know, I've been watching, especially today, you know, watching Nadal playing his match right now as we speak, and the conditions look like they're super fast and dry, and that's actually good for Raonic, I would think, but he lost the first set to Dutra Silva, but hopefully he can pull through.
Now, if you hadn't been a player and you were just a viewer, I didn't play on any type of clay till I was probably 20 or so, and only a couple times on grass subsequently. Which do you prefer as a viewer of the game? Not necessarily a player, because they all have different strengths, but was there a... I find with the French, obviously you get bogged down in longer rallies, and that said, there's some strategy to that, but as you know as a player, that extends your match out, and when you get into four or five sets, they're taking a lot longer than on grass or hard court.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for the average viewer, I think that the French is probably one of the most fun to watch for sure because of the surface, like you said, the definitely a lot longer rallies. It shows a lot of the athleticism from the players sliding all over the place and the rallies extend. But, you know, sometimes, you know, people want to see those kind of rallies and they want to see how physical tennis really is. And it just goes to show how good of athletes these guys really are. I think sometimes, you know, when you see the lightning fast surfaces, you know, you see how big the serves have come and how big the forehands have come, especially in the men's game, and the points are 3 to 4 balls long. So on the clay, it definitely extends the rally, and I think for the average viewer, it's more fun to watch that than just, you know, serve and 2-3 balls and that's it.
I mean, you're a fan now, but you're also friends with a lot of the players. So when you're watching and you see guys that you're friends with, like Nick Kyrgios or Madison Keys, who you coached for a little bit ending just last year, are you in contact with them during the French Open, or do you watch it a little differently than you might with other players?
I would say definitely. You know, obviously, I pull harder for some players than others. As you said, I'm friends with a couple of them, and I still keep in touch with a lot of the players on tour. So especially today, I mean, Steve Johnson, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw that match, but that was just unreal. Mm-hmm. He pulled through, and Steve actually just lost his dad just kind of maybe a couple weeks ago, and he flew back home, and you know, I sent him a nice text message, and Steve's actually a diehard Anaheim Ducks fan. So he's a big hockey guy, good friends with Timo Solani, actually. And he was over there and he pulled through an unbelievable match today, and you just saw him just break down at the end. So it was kind of – it was everyone I could tell was just so happy for him. I personally, as a friend and, you know, as a Steve Johnson fan, I was just happy to see him pull through that match. But it was really emotionally – training for him, that's for sure. And even for the viewer, for me watching, I even got a little choked up. It was tough to watch.
Jesse Levine's joining us on the Sportsnet Point Taken podcast, a former ATP player. Now, you were 15 when an American last won a slam, and it was Andy Roddick at the 03 U.S. Open. We all thought Andy Roddick would win more. Do you get asked, and what is your answer, when the next American will be? Because no one saw this coming, and whether it's Jack Sock or at times John Isner, we keep waiting for that one American male player to break through, and it's yet to transpire, right?
I think it's a great question. I really haven't been asked that, actually, but I think, you know, American tennis has definitely gotten really strong. They actually just hired a new head of men's competitive tennis, and Jay Berger is actually stepping down. And they hired Brian Boland, who is the former head coach at University of Virginia, who's an amazing, amazing guy and an amazing tennis fanatic, huge tennis guy. And in men's tennis, they had so much success at Virginia. He just won the national champion this year to finish out his college career, and now he's taking over that position of high performance for men's tennis in the United States. So that's a big hire. You'll see some changes coming that way for sure. I think American tennis is strong. I mean, you have Jack Sock, Steve Johnson, John Isner, Sam Querrey. You know, can those guys win a slam? I think maybe, you never know. It's hard to say, but that's a tough prediction to make. But it's definitely gotten a lot stronger. The amount of guys that are in the top 30, top 50, and top 100 now in U.S. tennis has definitely gone up over the last couple of years.
You've for years now kind of been in the heart of tennis in the States, in Florida, not just for Americans, but a lot of top players like Andy Murray, for instance, trained down in Florida. And when you were younger, you were at the Nick Baldessari Academy and you worked with him. Just for non-hardcore tennis fans, kind of explain what that type of place is like.
IMG is actually, I mean, the things that they've done to that place since I've been there and was training there is incredible. I mean, it's literally a city of its own. It looks like a college campus. I went back maybe 6 months ago. I was in the area and I wanted to go and see it. And I mean, the security just to get in alone now is it's pretty crazy. But they have, I mean, probably some of the best training facilities in the state of Florida, if not the country now. I think it's an amazing place. They've built a whole indoor center. They've built a new brand new gym. They have track. They have football. They used to even have a hockey academy there. That's no longer there, but they have baseball, they have soccer, they have football. I mean, it's just an amazing place to train. And you see, in a high-performance sport, whether it's tennis, whether it's soccer, whether it's football, when you bring in the best players from all over the place to train together, somehow you're going to bring top players out of there. They're going to push each other in different ways. And to have the best kids in the country all out training together, I mean, you just can't beat that.
Because who was there when you were there? Was Sharapova there, or were you?
Sharapova was there, yeah. Yes. Max Mirny trained there. Tommy
right.
Haas trained there. Andy Murray would come through. Goel Monfils would come through. Who else? Korda, Radek Stepanek. I mean, the list goes on.
Were you roommates with Nishikori?
Yes.
At one point?
Yeah. Nishikori was one of my roommates when I was there. He was an interesting character. He was very, very shy. But he worked his butt off, and he was a great guy, and we were very close, and actually still close to this day. And he used to always pretend while we were there that he didn't really speak English, but he definitely spoke fluently, and especially with me, because he trusted me, he would always make me not tell anybody that he would speak perfect English.
It's a tough thing too, because you're rivals with guys you want to sort of climb. I mean, I don't think broadcasting is that dissimilar. Sometimes you can be friendly, but you wouldn't want to see somebody who you didn't think was as good get promoted over you. You see that those pictures are in Agassi's book where he's standing next to Jim Courier, and you can kind of tell there's a thick level of tension because they both want to be the best at given times, right?
No, I mean, that's the competitive nature of sport and life in general. But you definitely see that in tennis because it's an individual sport. So, you know, yes, you're friendly, and yes, you're, I guess, training together. But at the same time, you want to do better than one another. I can definitely see that. But, you know, certain guys do have a true friendship with. And there are certain guys that even when I was at tournaments, I would go to dinner with. And, you know, I did have a real friendship with them. And then there are your guys that, you know, you got along with at tournaments and would just practice with, and, you know, you wouldn't tell them what's going on in your life because you don't want them to know.
I'm sure there's some guys that are like that, even when we think back to our, you know, being really young where, yeah, they were a lot more, if you can be introspective at 10 or 11, but you're just like, what's the deal with this kid? He doesn't like me. He's not being friendly. He's not being friendly to anybody, but that's just what he or she needed to do. I mean, people have accused Jeannie of that to some extent, right? And I always make,
yeah, for sure.
I always make the case if Jeannie were male, I think the media here would give her a lot less of a hard time. And they'd say she's hard-nosed, she's competitive, she's driven, and we give her a hard time because there's one persona on social media and there's another persona that just says, yeah, I'm not that into the whole fraternization thing. I want to win, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially on the Jeannie case, I mean, I've seen her practice. I've seen her in the gym, and her work ethic is second to none.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody sees, you know, what she posts on social media or, you know, what she's doing or how she does, you know, in the tournaments. But I'll tell you this, I mean, she works as hard as anybody out there, especially in the gym. She loves working out in the gym, and she definitely puts in the effort there, that's for sure.
And people just think of what they see on social media, right? So they assume, yeah, Milosh is putting in all the hard work, and she's not.
Very true. I mean, if you follow Carolyn on Instagram, you just assume there's a lot of coffee, there's a lot of walking, a lot of meals, and there's a lot more to her than that. There just is. There has to be, right?
It's like an onion. It's many layers. Okay, one of my favorite stories about you, Jesse, is because you're a lefty, and we know that for years, and I mean even still, Federer, he'd want as much practice as he could against lefties because of Nadal. And you were able to train with Federer. Was it just one off season or two where he flew you out to a couple places like Dubai?
I've gone twice with him. I went to Dubai once and I went to Turks and Caicos.
Oh, tough life.
It was pretty amazing. Actually, the Dubai story was funny because that's when I was in college. And I remember I got a phone call and I didn't recognize the number. And they're like, oh, hi, this is so-and-so. We'd like to know if you'd like to go and train with Roger Federer in Dubai. And, you know, me being, you know, 18 years old, I said, haha, who is this, you know, trying to play a prank on me? I thought it was one of my college teammates. And I said, good try. And I hung up the phone. And I was like, oh, maybe that might have been real. I don't know. I kind of panicked a little bit. And then 5 minutes later, they call back from another number. And they're like, no, this is really so-and-so from, you know. I was like, oh, wow, I'm so sorry. And I had to apologize. And ended up being an amazing experience. He flew me out to Dubai for 2.5-3 weeks and got to train with him there. And it was an amazing experience.
So you must be super intrigued by what Wimbledon will be. I mean, with the French on right now, and Federer skipping the French to focus on grass court and focus on Wimbledon. He'll be 36 later this summer. And I give Carolyn a hard time about her Federer love. And at the same time, it's not great. Like it's a little bit like that with Serena on the women's tour. It's not great that somebody 35 or 36 is so dominant. That's not supposed to happen. But I think the next, not just the clay court run here ending at the French, but they're going to be really interesting weeks for Andy Murray and for Novak Djokovic to not be conquered by Roger at Wimbledon. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it what also is amazing is when I was playing, the average age in the top 100 was probably around 25, 26. And, you know, if you were in your early to mid 30s, you were considered, you know, older. But now, if you look at the rankings, the average age in the top 100 is around 30, 31.
Yeah.
So it's really amazing what tennis has gone to with the age there. I mean, I just think that, you know, the physical level of fitness and, you know, diet, nutrition, and everything has just gone to the next level. That's letting guys and the women play a lot longer and into their mid and late 30s. And I think obviously Federer is a prime example of that.
Or are we possibly also, I trust your instinct on this, are we going through a run where we just haven't had a huge rush of young players? We haven't had, I mean, when I'm a kid playing, Boris Becker wins Wimbledon unseeded at age 17. We know that that alone will never, ever, ever, ever happen again. And at the same time, do we just have a run where there aren't – Zverev's very good, right? And
yeah.
Dominic Thiem from Denmark is – but we don't have a real run of 21-, 22-year-old superstars
yeah.
right now, right?
I think they have a really good crop of next-gen players is what they call it now. And mm-hmm. they actually have – a next gen masters at the end of the year, which is for players that are under 21 years old. And that's called the Race to Milan, actually. And that will take place around the same time as they do for London in the Masters. So you have guys like Thiem and you have guys like Zverev and you have, you know, the Kyrgios is coming up. I think there's a really good crop of guys that are coming up that are starting to push that field, but it's a slower process than obviously, like you said, when Becker was there winning a Grand Slam at that age. I mean, that's like unheard of now.
You were working with Raonic a little bit earlier this year down in Florida. How come it hasn't happened for him yet? And I mean happened for him. I mean getting to that next level and winning a Grand Slam.
I think for him it's just a matter of staying healthy. I mean, we all know that he has the game and he has the work ethic and he has the mentality to do it. He's a very, very intelligent guy and very smart on the court and really is learning how to utilize his game, especially with that serve that he has. But all aspects of his game have improved immensely, in my opinion. I think it's just a matter of time for him to figure out how to stay healthy and how to stay healthy for long periods of time, whether that's, you know, changing the schedule or, you know, playing less weeks in a row or more weeks at a time. I don't know what the solution is, but, you know, it's going to happen for him. It's just a matter of when. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's going to happen for him. We just, obviously, in Canada, everyone's just waiting for that moment to happen. And when it does, it's going to happen again and again. So he kind of needs to get that monkey off his back in the Grand Slam, because I personally think he will win a Grand Slam one day.
Yeah, I think that's the only fear is having for him, having the younger players, as you said, the next gen players that are coming. Just all of a sudden the finger snaps and Federer had that moment and Djokovic had that moment and all of a sudden they're dominant. Like Nick Kyrgios could be that player. We all see that. We see the talent. And if he starts winning, you know, 2.5 slams a year, then it's troublesome for a Raonic. It's troublesome for Nishikori. It's going to be hard for them to do it at an advanced age if there's guys 3-4 years younger who turn out to be great, right?
Yeah, I mean, Kyrgios is probably the most talented guy that I've seen in a long time. It's just, it's amazing the things that he can do, and he actually just made a big move. He hired a coach, Sebastian Grosjean, who's mm-hmm. former number 4 in the world, great player from France, and he actually lives here in Florida, which is pretty cool because Nick comes here all the time, as his girlfriend lives here as well. So I actually hit with him a lot of the time when he comes down here, and he's super, super good guy, and that's another a guy in the media that everyone thinks is, you know, a rough person, rough around the edges, but they just are on him so much because of the talent that he has, and they expect things to happen so fast. But I think that was a big move for him to hire a mature coach, someone that's been there before and in his shoes, in someone like Sebastian Grosjean. And I think we're going to see some big things from him in the near future, that's for sure.
Then if you look at the crop of the young Canadians coming up, like Denis Shapovalov, Felix Auger-Aliassime, I mean, where do you think their ceiling is? Nestor said last summer that he thinks Shapovalov, he could be a top 30 player.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. It's really hard to say, but I mean, I personally think that, you know, Canada has two of the top up-and-coming players in Shapovalov and Felix Auger-Aliassime because they have shown that they're at the world stage at a young age. And, you know, watching those crop of kids at that age, I mean, they're definitely top five in the world at that age, for sure. And, you know, it's just a matter of how are they going to mature physically and how are they going to mature mentally. I was actually really impressed with Shapovalov and how fast he kind of recouped after that Davis Cup incident. I thought it was going to take him a while to kind of recover from that, but he's done an amazing job and he's put together some really good results. And he just seems like physically he's a little bit stronger than Felix right now, but I think, you know, they're very close friends as well and on and off the court. So I think that they're going to be two guys that really are going to push each other in a really positive way.
Jesse Levine, our guest on Sportsnet Point, taking a couple more minutes with him. Give us a match that you recall. It could be one of the slam wins. It could not. Where you say this was absolutely, I couldn't miss. It's like being at the craps table. I couldn't miss. It was all rolling. To show my kids a DVD of it someday, this is me at my best. I could have beaten anybody on this given day in this one match. Who would that be?
I would probably say Murat Safin at Wimbledon in 2009. Mm-hmm. That was probably the best win of my career. It was the first round Wimbledon. We played on that show court 18, and I was just zoning in. It was just one of those where the tennis ball felt like it was as big as a basketball, and you're just seeing it. But I think that was one, and then the other one would be when I played Nadal in Toronto. I don't remember what year that was, but I literally didn't know where I was, and I was up 4-1. So for the first five games, that would be a video that I'd want to show my children one day because it was amazing, and I'll never forget. I was up 4-1 in center court Toronto, sat down on the changeover, looked at the scoreboard, and I was like, that doesn't look right. I don't know if that's the right score. And as soon as that happened, it was all over for me.
Now, did Safin break a racket in that match? We saw Johnson's opponent just annihilate his.
Yeah, he did. He broke a couple.
Good. That's a good sign. You know, yeah, you've got, yeah, you know, you're rolling the first broken racket in a Merritt Safin match.
For sure. Well, he definitely broke his fair share.
You haven't played Arash Madani yet, though, so that could be one of your best moments.
I know. Well, I actually gave him a pretty cool racket, so if he cracks that, I'll be really mad at him.
Yeah, Vikings racket, right?
Yep, custom made with his name on it.
That's a guy with a lot of time on his hands to drop that off, put the order in, pick it up, make sure it's okay, pay for it. That's really something. But he loves his tennis.
You play with some NHL guys, though. Who is the best hockey tennis player?
Okay, out of all the hockey guys that I play with, I gotta give Daniel Alfredsson is a very good tennis player. Actually, he's a very strange tennis player. He serves with one hand and plays hits forehands with the other, so it's a little bit strange, but he's a great athlete, super competitive, and he loves it, and it's always so much fun because growing up, he was like my idol as a Sens fan, so it was pretty cool.
I hate to tell you this, Jesse. I am that person. I am a left-handed server and overhand person, and I switch over. Like, I play golf left, I shoot hockey left, but I could not figure out why I liked a two-handed backhand, because it's like stepping in as a left-handed baseball hitter and using the forehand in my right hand instead of my left.
So do you have a two-handed forehand, too?
I do. No, I don't go Monica Seles. I go, it's just left-handed. It's left-handed serves and overhead. But it, you're right. I couldn't play for beans, but I'd be ahead of players way better than me for about three games in, and then they'd be like, oh, okay, I see what he's doing, and then they'd annihilate me. That's how generally it worked, but you'd fool them at first.
I haven't really seen that. I remember there was one kid when I played in juniors that did that, but really you don't see that too often. And then you got the Jensen brothers that they could serve and with either hand.
Yeah, Murphy and Luke could do that.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That made them mostly so entertaining. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man, I could not do that. That can be
you got
pro.
All summer to work on it.
Okay.
That's
fine.
Our next lesson.
Okay, yeah. I don't know you, right? Greg said I owe you for the one lesson.
I feel like you should invoice at some point if you're gonna be providing such free tips.
Now's a good time to end the interview.
She gives me broadcast lessons. I give her tennis lessons.
See,
fair trade.
You give and take.
Ah, the best serving the best. I like that. That's a good principle.
Jesse, thanks so much for coming on. Enjoy your time at the French Open.
Thank you so much.
That was great having Jesse Levine on. He's got the gift of gab. He'll be an excellent broadcaster. We'll be working for him, or not even working at all someday, depending on what he wants. Because some guys are so. Brad Gilbert, the broadcaster, was so kind of quiet and was a little surly, and we all know. Like, I think John McEnroe, it's remarkable. We just accept, God, he's one of the best in the business. He's a fantastic broadcaster. And yet, if someone had told you John McEnroe would be this amazingly personable, gregarious, outgoing broadcaster way back when, you'd be like, not a chance. He'll be miles away from the sport. But he loves it too much to be away from it for very long.
Well, and even Jesse talking about, too, the amount of players that he's known over the years in Florida. Tennis is a small sport. So you get to know people through generations really quickly and well, and the season's so long. So, I mean, he follows everything.
But he's got so much name-dropping. Turks and Caicos and
Dubai with Roger.
And first-class air, like, not even in coach.
Right.
Like, not flying United. It's all too much for some of us.
Living the dream.
Some of us who are just scraping by. And interesting in that he had the, he's got the great perspective on tennis in the U.S. That's why I asked him that about Andy Roddick. And yet he obviously feels very Canadian and very, and should. And it's neat to have that perspective from both sides of the border. Because that's the one thing people in the States would say to me. They're like, your guy, Raonic, is going to win a slam before anybody in the States is. And I'm like, yeah, it does look that way. And there's still that window to me of 2 or 3 years for Milos to do that before any American leaps off the page and is able to. I mean, we all look at these runs some guys make, and mostly been John Isner, and we're like, you just don't see it. There's too many giants to knock off 2-3 rounds in a row when the seeds all hold, right?
It's interesting, too, because it started a couple of years ago. I forget what the event was, but Chris Everett, she was doing the commentary, and she started talking about North American tennis instead of just talking about American tennis. Because you see it on ESPN and their tennis coverage and the Tennis Channel. They're talking about the Canadians constantly. And that's thanks to Milos and Jeannie and also Vasek, especially his success in doubles, but also these young players that we were talking about, Dennis and Felix. It's really exciting. I mean, the National Training Center in Montreal, it's coming up on the 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
And so you're starting to see now a full generation of players coming up who have grown up in that system.
Like, I can't quite put my finger on when it turned, and you just realized, you know what, Americans, not only are they not dominant anymore, and they've always sort of shared that with Sweden's always had great players with Edberg and Wielander, and obviously Federer's the best ever to come from Switzerland, Becker from Germany. But like, I just bring up randomly the 1987 U.S. Open, and on the men's side, the American seeds are 6, 8, 10, 12, and 13. So you knew you had players and opportunities to win Grand Slams, and they're just not there anymore.
Federer, he used to be very good friends publicly with a certain Mr. Tiger Woods, which brings us into the segment, What Up With That?
That's what we call it, and they were. Yeah, very probably a lot of Nike meetings, a lot of groundwork being laid.
They'd show up to each other's majors, though, remember? Times have changed.
I feel like they're in that one commercial in an elevator, or maybe that's Gillette.
I think it's Gillette.
With
Thierry Henry.
Yeah,
they were shaving, I believe.
Were they just holding razors, or were they actually in the process?
We'll have to go back to the vault. That's not what we're talking about, though. So Tiger Woods, as many of you know, early Monday morning in Florida, was stopped and he had a DUI, and the police report has come out. It said that he told police, as he said in his statement, that he was on different prescription medications. There was no alcohol shown in his breathalyzer. His car was damaged. He had 2 flat tires. So it begs the question, is this a recurring problem? Is the old Tiger ever going to be back? And I mean personal life and also...
Well, it made me think when I heard of it, a few different things. One is that it's a former golfer. Like, you're almost like ex-golfer based on where he's at the age of 41. And I always hesitate to be that person, that man, that woman that diagnoses somebody without even knowing them and spending time with them. So I've heard people say he's got to get some help. I don't know about that, because people can take prescription drugs or they can take alcohol, make a bad mistake, big error in judgment. I'm not minimizing drunk driving. It's not the worst crime you can commit, but it's not a good one to commit. And at the same time, Carolyn, I've never fallen asleep in a car. I've never fallen asleep in a running car and not known where I am when I wake up. So some of the police report stuff is sort of troubling in that you're like, this is, you worry it's more than just, oh, it's a bad reaction to something, which I'm sure I've had people call me and they've said, I took this, I had knee pain, I had knee surgery, I took something. I took too much. Then I did that at 1 p.m. I had a beer at 7 p.m. and just one, and it messed me up the rest of the night. I don't know if that was this or this is something a lot more serious than that. But the falling asleep in a car that's still running anywhere is the most concerning. It's one thing if you want to take a nap in the parking lot because you're waiting for a meeting to start and you want to close your eyes for 15 minutes. You and I are probably no stranger to napping anywhere, anytime, but not in a running car in a busy road, right? Not the case.
No, and I just think it's a shame because it's, as you said, it's a reminder that the Tiger Woods we once knew, I mean, we're coming up to a decade of him being gone.
Yeah.
And I mean, from 2009 when the personal problems started to come into the spotlight, and I mean, he hasn't won a major since 2008. It feels like now every couple months we hear, oh, wait, he might be coming back. He might finally be healthy. He feels the best he's ever had. I mean, he said that just a week ago.
Yeah.
So I think it's just the shame because he was a great champion. But unfortunately, that's not how he's been remembered in the past 10 years.
I don't see it as some like a scandal or a huge fall from grace. We've been surrounded by the... you know, this is almost the fall from grace. Even with celebrities, right? Your Bill Cosby, your Bill O'Reilly, your other people who, whether you watch a person, whether you are a fan of them, Lance Armstrong's the best example. Here's somebody who inspires people on so many levels and the whole Live Strong brand. And then you're like, ooh, like he was always, not only was he always cheating, he was always blackmailing people and lying about it and making people's lives miserable while he was trying to cheat. And that's to me not what this is, but I'm yet to think it's something bigger than he's just gotta dial down the medication a little bit. I've heard people say, well, he's obviously got a huge problem. I don't know that, and we can't know that yet.
No, because we don't know him personally. Okay, what up with that has gotten pretty sad. So we're gonna pick it up. Ready? So LeBron James, he says that when he's finished his career, he wants to own an NBA team, much like Jeter's trying to do right now. To me, this just screams, oh my goodness, LeBron James owning a team means no parity ever again in the NBA.
But what if he's the Michael Jordan of owners? That's
true.
That has not
then we don't have anything to
out.
Be concerned
and, and
about.
It looks like this Derek Jeter thing to buy the Miami Marlins with Jeb Bush, former presidential candidates, over also.
Yeah, but he wasn't contributing that much money. I think Jeb Bush was only contributing but $20 million. So, and it's, I mean, over $1 billion.
It's odd because there's so many success stories. Like we're watching... we had Kelly Rudy on. Mario Lemieux is a successful owner. John Elway has a financial stake in the Broncos with Pat Bowlen. So when you see these guys in their executive boost, George Brett with Kansas City, you're like, wow, and of course it's working. But there has to be a Michael Jordan and has to be. There's a lot of failed executives that were great at their sport that either tried to manage, tried to be a GM. And they never, I mean, I hate to say it, in Canada, we often use the example of Wayne Gretzky coaching. Not that he had great, talented teams, but ask anybody in the hockey world, and they're like, yeah, it wasn't a really good fit. It's hard to even think now and reflect that he did that. It really is. Like, it was happening, and we understood it, and I was in scrums when he'd come into Detroit with the then Phoenix Coyotes, and you'd be like, you'd be driving home and you'd be like, oh my God, Wayne Gretzky's coaching the Phoenix Coyotes. Like it kind of hits you like that. I don't know. I wonder how involved LeBron would be. He certainly should be able to put up the dough to get involved if he's doing all the right things financially. Tiger Woods could co-own the team with him.
Oh, there you go.
Maybe that would be something.
See, full circle. I would love for LeBron to own a team because I think it would be great for him to stay in the league. And the nice thing about owning, too, you can kind of be as involved as you'd like, or you can leave a lot of it to the president and GM. But as we've seen with LeBron on his teams, he's in charge.
He's very much, very. You wouldn't want him firing a coach every 2 months. You're not going to be able to. Yeah,
no.
I mean, he has gotten a few coaches fired, as Michael Jordan did.
Correct.
As a lot of big players have, yeah.
Okay, this is one of my favorite events of the year. It happens in England. It's the cheese rolling race. Have you seen this on television?
Yeah.
It's guys being, they're throwing themselves down a hill, chasing cheese, and whoever gets there first wins the cheese. Is this the most ridiculous but amazing event you've ever seen?
You notice women aren't dumb enough to do this. Most of them are men. Most of the participants happen. It's like the hot dog eating contest. Never mind how unattractive it is to stuff countless hot dogs into your gob.
Ugh.
But it's one of those. I lost
my appetite.
I think the bed. No, not the bed pushing. There's an event
the
where
the wife carrying.
Well, there's that.
That's good.
I've seen that. But there's the make a device that you think can fly.
Yes.
And then they just go off a cliff and there's soft stuff, supposedly. Maybe it's water underneath. But everybody thinks they can make their own plane, like in their backyard with wood and a fan propeller. And it doesn't. And yet some are more successful than others. They don't all have the same tragic, awful finish to them. But those are the ones you guys run at the end of your sportscast, the worst ones,
right? Just burst out laughing. I couldn't even read the script this week. And this is what I love, though, from this story. It's from the host of the event. And he said, yesterday's champ took home his 20th wheel, but this time he's sending his prize to auction because he says he finds the taste too strong.
Name your three favorite cheeses.
I'm not a big cheese fan. I mean, I like it, but nothing fan like brie.
You've advocated avocado toast. But
love avocado toast.
You're not in like I
can't have both, or you can never afford a house, right?
Very well. Swiss cheese is awfully, and you don't eat with the holes in them. You don't even get proper value for the Havarti's and the mozzarella's are the same price as the cheese with all the holes in. But if you're going to get a sub made, what are you asking for? You must
cheddar.
Get something. Are you get cheddar?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a person of routine like that too. There's not a lot of I'll try a new beer. I won't try a new cheese.
I know what you mean.
I know what I like right now, and I got that stick-to-itiveness, as hockey coaches say, when it comes to three or four cheese flavors.
So either we're cheap or we know ourselves really well.
Like Gouda, I won't go near Gouda. I won't go near anything that's got that red peel on it. I'm really sensible and conservative with the cheeses. Really sensible and conservative.
Look at us. What a duo. That's it for another
that
episode.
Was it.
We've lasted
we
a
ended
month.
On cheese? That's okay. That's okay to end on, yeah. We should have asked Jesse Levine. And see, if we know ahead of time, Jesse Levine could rank the cheeses.
It's too late.
It is too late.
What could have been?
Our thanks to Ryan Mond for helping put this together. You can hear us always on sportsnet.ca/590.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse Levine was excellent. Kelly Rudy was excellent. This is a fun time of year to do this because NHL Stanley Cup Final and NBA Finals, and we'll be knee-deep in the NBA Finals when next we speak to people. Correct?
Oh, correct. Absolutely. I thought you were just ending it with that.
Yeah.
I was paying attention. Now I'll just say a final. See ya.
Yeah. We didn't know if you were nodding or nodding off.
No, I thought you were ending the podcast with that.
The podcast can end with that. We'll see everybody next week.
Bye.
You've been listening to Point Taken with Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady on sportsnet.ca/590.